Thanks. I'm very excited to be here. And I've got, like I always do, I begin this session with a question. Where are debate rounds won and lost? If you're in my club, you can't say it because you already know the answer probably.
Cross-examination.
Cross-examination, that's a good answer.
1AR.
1AR. You say before the round. And you say?
1AC.
The 1AC. Very good answer. You say?
After the round.
Really? When the judge fills out the ballot, flips a coin. Okay, affirmative it is. Hand in the back.
I think they're lost in your mind. Or one in your mind.
One in your mind. Did you do LD last year? Are you an idealist?
In the flow, because if you don't flow well, then you can't speak well. Because I didn't flow well last year.
Flows are absolutely essential. Actually, who said before the round? Hannah did. In the library, of course. This is all about research. So I'm so excited when I talked to Chris and Chris put this together. I was so excited because research is everything when it comes to debate, knowing how to run it. So who said before that Hannah gets candy? You got candy yesterday, though, didn't you? Or Monday? Good catch. When I sat down with my club actually put together this resolution for this year, and I'm so excited that it was selected, and that's because of their work it was selected. There was actually a process that we went through, and I'll introduce you guys to briefly, and everybody who's ever created a resolution has always gone through this process whether they realized it or not. And that is, they started with a controversial subject, and they go into sort of this U-shaped phenomenon where they, okay, there's a controversial subject, we can say it's environmental policy, or we can say it's healthcare, or NATO, or illegal immigration, or there's something that's controversial. And about, there are claims that arise out of that. You know, you think of all kinds of claims about illegal aliens, about school funding and hospitals and so forth. Out of that, there come issues. And from the issues, we arrive at a resolution, because issues will determine whether there's a sufficient breadth and depth for a fair debate, a fair and open debate on both sides of the resolution, so then the resolutional wording can then be drafted and submitted to the committee. It's a fun process to go through. I encourage you guys to all go through the process of drafting a resolution at the end of this year and submitting it to the committee. It's a fun process to go through. When we think of research, we want to begin thinking about a timeline in a linear fashion. There's a news cycle where information comes out to us. How many know what happened when I say the Mumbai terror attacks? Anybody know about that? We have some extempers in the room. That's good. In November 2008, November 26th, there was a terror attack. Some Pakistanis invaded the city of Mumbai and attacked a hospital, some terrorists. How'd the world find out about that first? You want to know? Go ahead.
Wasn't there a phone call from somebody?
Phone call and what else was there? Starts with a T, ends with an R.
Twitter,
yeah. Twitter has become this phenomenon. We see it, we saw it with Mumbai, we saw it with the Italian earthquakes in April. We've seen it with the elections, both before and after, especially the aftermath of the Iranian elections. We see this whole Twitter phenomenon where people get online and we're getting more information out right away than ever before because of this social phenomenon. When we think of the timeline here, we have things that happen immediately. Think of an automobile accident. All right, there's Tina text messenger is in an accident with the Isaac iPod, and they both think the other one's at fault. One's listening to his radio, the other one's texting while she's driving. They're in an accident. Who's the primary source? Who's the who's going to be the one that the insurance company is going to listen to most closely after that claim? Is it going to be Tina or Isaac?
Tina.
Neither. It's going to be an eyewitness, somebody who was external to the accident who said, yeah, they both ran a stop sign and hit each other because they were so distracted. And that's actually a case that happened that ended up with 50% liability on each case, so we didn't have to pay out for the other party. It was wonderful. When those kinds of things happen, eyewitnesses become important. John, how many know have read the first epistle of John? Starting in the first chapter, he says, that which is from the beginning, which we have seen with our eyes, which our hands have handled, concerning the word of life. There's this wonderful thing that he's presenting himself, building his ethos before the judge, right? His credibility. He's saying, we have this eyewitness account that we have. We've actually been there and seen. He's actually confronting a Gnostic heresy that Jesus wasn't human. And so he says, no, we've handled it with our hands. You know, we understand what we're saying is true. And so he's an eyewitness account. He becomes our first. He's setting himself as a primary source. And we see the first, you know, Twitter. The spacing is kind of odd here, in the way it presents here. But we have Twitter. We have broadcast news the next day. A week after, we might see Newsweek come out with an article or something like that. Now we have online publications and salon websites and so forth. Journals, you know, the months following the accident or the incident. The Mumbai, January of 2009, right on time with this timeline, Foreign Policy Journal has an article about the Mumbai terror attacks. And in their article, they're actually talking about the impact of social media, Twitter, on foreign policy implications, on how State Department officials might be using Twitter, and how we can, you know, soldiers in the field. And so we're really kind of an interesting article that you could read, but that comes in a month or so in the months following. And the year following the event, we're going to see reference works, government publications, the National Safety Council, the National Traffic, you know, Board will have a study that'll come out involving cell phone use and text messaging, and how they relate to accidents, whether it's a train or an automobile, and they may reference 100 or 1,000 accidents that involve people like Tina and Isaac that were involved in an accident, and they're compiling it all together. So that's a year or so following the event. There was just a book right on timeline with this. That's why I'm centering on Mumbai, because it's such a great example here. A book just came out last month that alleges that Musharraf, who knows who Musharraf is? Who's not an extemper, okay? I love extempers, this is wonderful. Musharraf, a former head of the Pakistani government, that he was in this conspiracy with ISI, which is sort of a cross between their CIA and the Gestapo, that they went and tried to attack India and undermine their government. It's not believable. It's written by an Indian, a Pakistani-hating Indian. But it's interesting because it's right on the timeline. That's when books start coming out. And so as we look at timeline and news cycles, this becomes, I know yesterday you probably talked about dates and recency of information. Which is a better date for information, 2008 or 1998? Well, it depends what the information is. If it's the precedent-setting Supreme Court case, 1998 is perfect. But we're talking about particulate emissions and so forth, 2008 is going to be much better. And you wouldn't want to quote 1998. In these sources, we're going to see some sources are better than others. You know, as we look at, the sources, we look for sources. I actually won a round when I was in high school. Somebody quoted TV Guide. It was wonderful. I just bowed my head and closed my eyes and thanked the Lord for the victory I was about to receive. And it was a tremendous experience. But in general, you don't want to be quoting sources that are just crazy. As you have over here, we have this. You guys probably have binders, and you know, everything's really neat and orderly for you. You might have boxes like this, like we used to have, or your briefs are in files or so forth. But you want to move from the position this young lady's in, where she's staring at these books and at a blank computer screen, to a box full of evidence. Ultimately, that's what this camp is designed to do. How do we get from one place to the other? We want to find the right research. The first part is developing a strategy. The strategy for your research needs to think, first and foremost, what am I trying to accomplish? What is debate? What is the purpose of debate?
Solve problems.
What else? Yes? Solving problems and sharpening thinking skills are both benefits. The ultimate purpose is to elucidate, to arrive at the truths, to promote clarity. So all the discussion about false evidence and so forth, you'll see a session on that later and so forth, all that gets around the purpose of debate, which is arriving at the truth. So as you have that in mind, you want to think, first of all, in environmental policy, What's our historical precedent? Let's get a historical perspective. What was environmental policy in the Nixon administration when the EPA was set up? What was it before the Nixon administration? What is it today? Comparative. What is it perhaps in the United States as opposed to other countries? Because a lot of the vociferous information or evidence sites that you'll read talk about how bad our environmental policy is, and you have to ask yourself, compared to what? Plan your research pattern, pick your primary sources. Obviously, you want to be ethical. And most important thing, never think you're done. Now, spotting biases, is that easy to do? Or can you tell when you're reading a biased source?
Sometimes.
And that's where, hopefully at the end of this session, we'll have a better section on that. Now, when we begin with...
Can you go back to the
okay. As we develop this strategy, we want to have a good handle on what we know and don't know about the resolution. Right now, many of you are in a position where you don't know what you don't know. At the end of this week, maybe you'll be in a position where you do know what you don't know. As you continue your research, you want to be able to be focused and driven. And this is going to hopefully save you the 12 or 20 hours you maybe have spent last season staring at a computer not knowing where to begin and getting lost in some Facebook page because it was more interesting than whatever topic you were researching. As we move on and creating our strategy, encyclopedias, are they good sources? Encyclopedias are excellent sources if you know how to use them. Wikipedia, never quote Wikipedia because any idiot in the world can get on there and write an article. Wikipedia still is a great place to begin. Encyclopedia Britannica, any of the online dictionaries are wonderful. Now, I've said that you never want to quote Wikipedia, but it's a great place to begin. What do I mean by that?
If you don't know anything on the topic, it's really simple to find an easy readable article about it.
Absolutely. You can begin answering the question, what don't I know about this topic? Where should I be going? Over here and then Shane.
Most of the sources are cited. So it's actually a way to go and not only confirm them, but that also gives you a lead where you can find other information regarding the topic.
Through footnotes and bibliographies and excellent, absolutely. That's probably the most important aspect of an encyclopedia article. Shane.
Yeah, I was going to say what you said.
Exactly. So it should drive your research in the right areas. Now, as you select sources, you'll have a host of sources. I mentioned journals earlier, the Foreign Policy Journal, a number of different journals that are available. Journals are scholarly pieces that are just excellent. They're more focused. Are they agenda-driven? Absolutely. Every journal is published by some think tank or some organization who has some purpose in their writing. So... The American Medical Association is going to be very pro-Obama healthcare in their articles, even though most doctors will be perhaps against it. So you understand what the source is. That's why on the board here I say flow it. You know, over there it says get it on the flow. The most important thing you can flow, you're probably not flowing, and that's the site. Who said what, when did they say it, and where was it recorded? As we look at the different options, we have popular magazines. You're probably not going to be hearing much from these. We're going to talk about secondary primary sources in a minute, but if you look at different magazines like Time, Newsweek, U.S. News and World Report, National Geographic, you say, well, I would never use National Geographic in a debate. National Geographic has an article about the Sahara Desert having more vegetation in it today than it has in the last 1,000 years because of climate change, because of moisture in this arid desert. So there's interesting information that, again, can take you different places. You have a climatic change journal. You have economic indicators. This is a fun piece. If you guys don't know about this, you guys just I put that out there just so you guys would know about it, especially if you're extempers. Really fun sources here, government publications that are available. But what is a primary and secondary source? The most important thing to consider here, you can be in a round where somebody is screaming out their arguments or stating it vociferously or their piece of evidence is just this awesome piece of evidence because they use such all, you know, just destructive language that say, oh, that makes my point. I've been searching for a piece of evidence that would say what I needed to say for the point that I have, which is kind of a silly way of researching. But when you have to understand, and this is why I wanted to give this lecture, this slide right here, because an argument forcefully delivered is not the same as a forceful argument. What is a forceful argument? How many know what four-point refutation is? All right, that's part of what a forceful argument is. An argument that is, yes?
A forceful argument is something that isn't like a forcefully delivered argument stated, you know, in a forceful way. It's made, it's a very well-made argument, and it's structured really well, and it's easy for the judge to understand, and it's based on either very strong logic or very strong pieces of evidence.
I like that. It's like one person said, I like his argument. It also has the benefit of being true. You know, a forceful argument is one that is true. A forceful argument is one that can be defended. One that, how often have you guys won or lost a round based on a single piece of evidence? Really? In all the rounds I've judged, I've only decided it twice on a piece of evidence. One was a prelim round and one was an out round. So it's important to have, what's authoritative evidence? English is a funny language. What does authoritative mean?
Would that be like someone who is learned on the subject?
Yeah, I mean, if we're talking about environmental policy, you know, Coach Baker said the other day is not the same as the EPA came out this morning and announced. See, so the source is part of it. And well, who are you quoting? Where was it recorded? As we get started, let's think of what primary research is. Caitlin, what's four-part refutation? Four-point refutation?
Not sure, Coach Sparks.
Who has taken that and knows? Who can? I see some shy hands. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah. Four-part refutation is stating your argument. I'm his son, too. Stating your argument. Stating their response to your argument, and then,
That's good. It's actually something that I do with my kids, is I'll say, well, the most important thing that you can have in a round is something, that the most important thing you can say in a round is something that stays on the judge's flow. If you can say something, make an argument that stays on their flow, it's going to be important. So you want to make sure that when you're making it, you signpost the argument, you cite their tagline accurately, you're not rewording their argument, you're not putting words in their mouth. You briefly paraphrase what their argument is. So you're not going to twist their argument or anything else. Okay, they have said this, then, you know, under inherency one, you know, and you can state the tagline briefly and then say what they're arguing. All of this takes about 30 seconds to do, maybe less. Then you say what your response is to their argument. And the most important part is the significance or the impact statement. Impact is the final point of the refutation. You want to make sure the most important question in any debate round is so what? You're saying something, what's that mean to me? What's it mean to the judge? If you follow that, this is 5 points, just because I want to make sure that people signpost and tag their arguments so that they're directing the judge to where the argument was said in the 1AC, for example. As you go through that, that's theory and off track of what we're doing right now. But if I say something you don't know, let me know. Now, when we go into, what's a primary source? Give me one example. The eyewitness of the accident. I saw Tina and Isaac both run the stop sign. So look at this. Primary sources are original, uninterpreted information, unedited firsthand. It's always better to have a primary source than a secondary source. Is that true? I think it is true. It's always more effective to have a primary source in your case than a secondary source. However, there's a lot more secondary sources, and the secondary sources say all kinds of cool things that you say, oh, that's a much more powerful tagline. I've got to have that. And so you want to think what the primary source does for you. Now, secondary sources, I don't want to suggest that they're bad. They're wonderful. They're going to involve interpretation. A primary source might be a 500-page excerpt from a government publication, full of statistical data and completely boring for you and the judge. A secondary source will tell you what that means and have certain quotes from it. Secondary sources are wonderful and can be very effective. It's a little less reliable. It can be easily pressed often. It's the most common kind of evidence you're going to find in a round. So what's an example of a secondary source? Probably everything you looked up yesterday. If you go to Google, if you go to the page Google found, you know, so forth, what's beneficial about the secondary sources is where they take you if you're asking the right questions. The secondary source should take you to the primary source. The secondary source should let you go back farther and farther and farther. You know, if you're running a case on dam management in the United States and you're focusing on the Colorado River, who manages the resources of the Colorado River? What is the enforcement mechanism? What is the federal government's role? What's the state's role? You know, who adjudicates the proceedings? Is there a separate court process, or you know, is this the Ninth Circuit that oversees? You know, all these kinds of questions that you might ask as yourself as you're going through an article drive you farther back to primary sources. Just in case you didn't know, please don't quote Twitter or Facebook in a round. We want to make sure that your sources are authoritative and effective, so you're going to be quoting a lot of secondary sources. What you absolutely must know is the primary source. You've got to absolutely know what environmental policy is if you want to significantly change it. Yes?
Okay, now what if you're quoting from people that did research and did studies on people using things like Facebook and Twitter? I believe like last year people were quoting studies like by Vivek Wadhwa from Harvard, and I think he did several studies using Facebook to get information. Would you still want to quote that same study, or would you rather find a different study that says the same thing?
Sarah Palin this week on her Facebook page said, don't do that, right? You don't want to quote a Facebook page. If somebody's done scholarly research looking at social media and has put in the right parameters and so forth, that is something that is academic and can be included in academic debate. There are several benefits. One of the things you're trying to do for the judge is let the judge know that you have thought this argument through. You have seen, if you're the affirmative, there's a need for a change. It's significant. And you have thought all the issues through, and you're aware of the problems in the status quo and what the best solution is. Or if you're the negative, why the status quo is the best, or why their crazy idea is worse than what we have now. You're able to do that effectively if you have primary research. Wouldn't it be nice if somebody came out in a primary research and said something that would just decimate the affirmative that you're going against as a negative? It'd be great if you had that. Coach Baker on Monday night talked about developing a file box throughout the year. You ought to be doing that, and you ought to be filling it with both primary and secondary sources, because you never know. What's the biggest advantage the affirmative has in a round? Go ahead. Okay, they have evidence right here in front of me.
They know what the debate's going to be about.
They know what the debate's going to be. Shane?
They speak first and last.
They speak first and last. Sarah?
That's what I was going to say. They have less.
Hannah?
They have unlimited prep time.
Unlimited prep time. The biggest advantage, think of a 360-degree circle. The biggest advantage the affirmative has is they can come at you from any angle. There are 1,000 case ideas on this specific resolution. They might be very similar, some are very similar, some are very different, some might be squirrely, some might be, you know, excellent cases. You've got to prepare to address whatever they come at you with. That's their biggest advantage. How many of you win the majority of your affirmative cases? If you're an LD, don't hold up your hand, because I'm just kidding. If you win the majority of your affirmative cases, you're like 80% of students in any league. 80% of the time, the affirmative wins. Now, don't feel bad if you've lost all your affirmative. Hopefully, we'll work on that. The negative should be winning more. And the reason the negative isn't winning most of the time is because of this reason here. They're not preparing properly for their research. We'll talk about that. I'm not going to get into theory beyond that. Secondary sources, These have several advantages. They're all over the place, first of all. They're abundant. We can find them. You open up Google News, whatever. You can start doing a search. Coach Baker yesterday talked to you about some advanced search techniques, wild cards, Boolean operators, a number of different ways of finding a plethora of information out there. You can actually go and do a search that isolates government pages or think tank pages and so forth. As you do that, you're going to find there's a whole bunch of secondary source material out there that specifically, in a scholarly way, addresses the resolution. And that should take you, to primary sources also. But what's wonderful about secondary sources is somebody said earlier, we got to make this understandable to the judge. Young man, the blue shirt, I forget your name.
Jeffrey.
Okay, you said we want to make the argument understandable for the judge. Secondary sources allow that to take place. Primary sources are sometimes difficult to do that with. These are plan specific often. How many know what a plan advocate is? Isn't it great to have a plan advocate for your plan? Some super smart guy who said, yeah, this ought to be done. There ought to be a plan. Like, great, we ought to do what this smart guy said. That's what secondary sources allow you to do. The disadvantage here is it tends to be agenda-driven, tends to be biased. It's easy to press. Here's an example. How many people have heard... I'll start as you finish the statement here. Bush lied, people died, right? You've heard all kinds of articles, and you've seen articles in the news, you've heard news reports, you've heard politicians and people coming out, protesters, opposed to the Bush doctrine. What is the Bush doctrine? Yes. Yeah, and good luck putting a lasso around that one, right?
The preventative strategy or the preemptive strike strategy.
Okay, what is preemptive and preventative war? That's what Gordon Mitchell is going to, huh?
Hit them before they hit us.
Hit them before they hit us, kind of like we had in the Cold War. Gordon Mitchell, super smart guy, super liberal guy. Happens to be a college debate coach and has his own website and writes all kinds of policy pieces. He gives a definition here between preventive and preemptive attacks. So the preemptive attack, something like he mentions the British attacking before Napoleon can marshal his forces and reoccupy Egypt. Preventive strategy might be something like when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. What they weren't after Hawaii, they weren't after the United States. What they were after is Indonesia and the Philippines for rubber and oil and coal and mineral deposits that they needed to run a war machine. And the only problem was the Philippines were a U.S. territory. So if they invade the Philippines, we're going to respond, won't we? Probably we wouldn't have, but maybe we would have. But to make sure that we couldn't respond, they attacked Pearl Harbor to destroy our Pacific Fleet. So they were trying to prevent us from responding. And so he likens this and compares this and so forth. It's if we were having a resolution on this topic, this would be a great card to read. Hugh Hewitt, how many know who Hugh Hewitt is? Radio show host. How many of you know that for the last 20 years he's been a partner in a law firm that specializes in environmental policy? He writes his article for the San Francisco Chronicle, and in it he says, he references the Delhi Sands flower-loving fly. Who ever heard of that before? It's on the list. It's an endangered species. And maybe you can't mow your lawn because of this stupid fly. Or some of you may be aware that Congress passed a ban last year on certain types of plastics that are used on all-terrain vehicles and so forth, all because it sounded like a good idea at the time. Well, he's talking in this article, he's talking about the problem with government changing things is the government has a force of law behind it. You have men with guns that will show up at your door if you're breaking the law. So if you're mowing your lawn and you're endangering this fly, you might... be in serious trouble. So when we look at these guys, which one is, they're both secondary, right? Both are good. The reason they're both good is because they're both experts in their field. I may not agree with Gordon Mitchell. He's a smart guy, super liberal guy. Great thinker. I may not agree with his point, but I like his evidence, right? And Hugh Hewitt, I may agree with him, but that's not why I quote him. I don't quote people that I agree with. I quote because I'm trying to look for the truth. Remember, I'm going to find people that say the right thing. So he has the benefit of being a former debater and extemper. So I like him for that reason too. But in his blogs, in his posts, he says interesting stuff. Somebody Monday night said they have experience looking up case law, legal research. I'm not sure who that was. That was you. If you have a chance to do wonderful stuff, even in the Ninth Circuit and so forth, you might find briefs written by Hugh Hewitt or others. There's wonderful stuff. There's all kinds of environmental law out there and case studies. But it's a lot easier to find the secondary sources that can then take you back to, Reed versus State or whatever the case might be. Now, as we're trying to decide what kind of sources, where we research and so forth, if the resolution this year, instead about environmental policy, dealt with defense expenditures, what would be the best source of information? Where would you begin? Where do you think you'd begin your research to figure out if we should significantly change our defense spending? Yes, sir. So what is our current spending, if we should change it? So where would you find that? What do you think that would be like? Would that be a government source?
It would have to be government.
Have to be government.
If you want to see what the actual numbers are. If you want some estimate, yeah, you can try Fox. But
okay.
If you want the actual numbers, you want something from government or Treasury.
Mm-hmm. Shane?
I'd say I'd probably get a lot of congressional testimonies there because they help a bunch of games.
How many of you actually looked up congressional testimonies before? Yeah. A lot of it's really fascinating. Oh, if it's on your topic, it's so dry. Oh, my goodness. It's terrible reading.
Yeah. You have to go through a lot to get to find the needle in the haystack.
Yeah, that's the problem. Even if you have NexisLexis or you have different sources that you can, that are specialized research engines, you go to a university and so forth, it's still a challenge to find certain things you're looking for. Information is available, especially since the Freedom of Information Act. Do you know what the Freedom of Information Act is? What's that? What is it?
The government is, they're like required, they can't, unless it's like top secret information, there's some classification that has to be, or else they can't withhold it from the public.
Yeah, Stalin said it doesn't matter who casts the vote, it only matters who counts the vote. If you have a secret government who's in charge of everything, it doesn't matter what power you think you have. The government really is. What the Freedom of Information Act does is return the government to the hands of the people. We now can look at things and find out what's going on, as long as it's not top secret. We don't want to endanger lives of troops and so forth. So
then, like, it's so hard to find. You almost can't look at it.
Yeah. Isn't the Abrams tank a cool tank? That's just a cool tank. Anyway. Here we have a statistical abstract of the United States. All right, this is a wonderful source that's going to tell you exactly how we spent our money, where we spent our money. It's secondary. It's U.S. government, but it's secondary because it's culled from different department reports. So it, but it's authoritative, so it's also kind of primary. You're going to reference this one. You're not going to go to the Defense Department budget. This one is the actual one that gets scrubbed and so forth. They refer to a table here. I didn't show you all of that, but they talk about how much money we've spent in defense outlays from 1960 to 2009 and so forth. You can go to, there's a government source. Well, the only thing I'm pointing out here is, in all the years I've been judging NCFCA rounds, I've almost never heard a government source quoted. But it's a wonderful source to quote if you want to find authoritative information. After all, you want to significantly change government policy, right? So how do you do that if you don't know what government policy is or what government expenditures are and so forth? And so there's even a little website here and so forth, kind of cool. This is interesting. this site saying that 54% of the government budget goes to military expenses. 46% goes to non-military expenditures. Isn't that outrageous? What are we? Are we some sort of military state or something? Are we some ten-horned dictatorship? Why is so much of our of every dollar that that's collected by the, from the taxpayers going to fund this military war machine? Well, this crazy kooky site that I happen to find for you has done something really dishonest. And this is why secondary sources should ultimately take it. You want to make sure you do two things. One, you want to make sure you accurately quote what the person is saying. And two, you want to make sure that they're accurately handling the information. This is an example. You can have misrepresentation from two, you can have dishonest, intellectually dishonest information from two perspectives. One perspective, the person could be lying. Lying gets to a motive and so forth. They could just be twisting the facts. The other side is negligence. Negligence is much more common. This is where you just didn't do your homework. You just don't know. They said on the board, you read it, you said, oh, that'll work for this argument. You cite it, and you start perpetuating a lie without ever investigating it. So it's really super important that as you're reading things, you ask yourself, is that true? How do I know that's true? Here is 54%. Well, 54% is military if you take all the people that are on government retirement, military or otherwise, and all the people who are receiving health care benefits, Social Security, the VA system, all the people who are military prisoners, all the people who are anywhere, so, contractors, civilian applications aside, take all that money together and you say, yeah, here we are, and all this money is being spent. It's completely dishonest, the way they presented this argument. So this is classic misrepresentation. And when you see this kind of thing, it's easy here, especially I would just go out on a limb here and say most people in the room are conservative in their politics. You look at this and say, well, that can't be right. And plus, they got War Resisters League. That's got to be liberal. They've got to be wrong. Just the name tells me they're wrong. Well, the most important thing you can do is figure out where they get their numbers and what's right. How would you figure that out? Viscerally, emotionally, logically, you say that can't be right. How do you know if it's right or wrong? Yes, sir.
You were at the National Data Book.
Yeah, just go back to the previous slide. It's not rocket science here. We're going to say, well, what did the government say? Where's our money being spent? And then you say, and if someone reads a slide like this, and it might say, that there are 50,000 endangered species that are going to be extinct, Judge. If we don't change this, pass this plan today, nobody wants dead puppies. I hate dead puppy arguments. But if there's 50,000 different species, from puppies to flies, they're all going to be extinct if we don't, nationalize the car industry and do something else that must be done today, then you have to ask yourself, you have to figure out where they're getting their facts and be able to press it effectively. Because a forceful argument is one that has the benefit of being true, not the one that sounds dramatic. Here's an example. How many of you saw the cover of this Newsweek magazine? It almost made me want to cancel my subscription. My agency, I get Newsweek and a couple different news magazines, so people waiting to get a quote on their car insurance can come in and read a magazine. And I saw this, I didn't even put it out. I'm like, ugh! Is Christianity in decline? You say no. How many say no? How many say yes? How many say, I don't know? How many want it to be wrong? Of course, we all want it to be wrong. This is a great piece of agenda-driven news. This is a secondary source, of course. We want to. I bring this up because we want to be able to spot bias. When bias comes in and says, the decline and fall of Christianity, of Christian America, it comes from a saying, they say, well, when George Herbert Walker Bush and Bill Clinton were president, the number was always 50%, 58% or higher, but now it's 48% of the people that say religion can answer all or most of today's problems. Now, let's assume for a moment that 48% is true. 48% of Americans say that religion can answer our problem or has a solution for our problems. Is that evidence in of itself that Christianity's in decline? Why not?
It depends on who they poll.
Okay, let's assume that was a scientific study referencing, say, 20,000 adults between the ages of 18 and 65, for example, cross-section of American culture, including Hindus, Muslims, Christians of all denominational stripe.
In that case, that was, did you say 20,000?
Let's assume it's 20,000.
20,000 out of how many people in America?
Well, if it's just statistical sampling, you know, it doesn't really matter. Yeah.
I mean, it's a poll for goodness.
Right, but it can give us an indication.
Somewhat.
Does it trouble you to know that less than half of the country believes that religion has the answers? What churches do you guys belong to? How many are Methodist here? How many are Episcopalian? All right, how many are Anglican? Same thing, isn't it? How many are Conservative Baptist? How many are Mennonite? How many are Jesuit? How many are Pentecostal or Charismatic in some fashion? Most people that go to church on Sunday morning in America today go to a church that is, whose congregation size is 800 people or larger. Most of those churches identify the people. We have the Jesus and me phenomenon. You know, people are in this jam session with Jesus. You know, it's Jesus and me. So they don't identify modern culture, modern America. Christians don't identify themselves denominationally. You know, I'm Presbyterian first and Christian second. You know, it's okay as long as it was, you know, Scofield Notes and Scripture Press, you know. And people don't think in those terms today. Most people identify themselves non-denominationally. And it's not a bad thing because people don't want religion, they want a relationship, right? So when people come and ask you, religion sounds like a foreign title to you, a foreign name. No, I don't have a religion, I have a relationship with Jesus Christ. Well, so if you're polling the same people and the number is going down, that perhaps that's an indicator. Well, what's interesting is the Scrooge Report comes out and they have their article here, which is really kind of funny. They're responding to the Newsweek and how they misquoted the polls. So here we have Newsweek, a secondary source, and then the Scrooge Report reports on what Newsweek said and references the original study. So here we have, is this a tertiary source? So it's a secondary source, but quoting and interpreting a secondary source. And so here he has this, you know, this post online where he's talking about this article and how bad this is. And as a church that got into the mix, Pyro Marketing is a website that, you know, run by this particular church, and they come out and they they talk about the decline in circulation for Newsweek. You know, so who is really in risk of extinction, the Church of Jesus Christ or Newsweek magazine? You know, so they're joyfully proclaiming a post-Newsweekly America. So, you know, I love when people are funny with this kind of stuff. As we look at it, we actually would want to go back to the American Religious Identification Survey of 2008 and find out what was said there, how was the information gathered, and then interpretation of that, whether it's Jonathan Alter and the magazine that he edits, who would love to see a post-Christian America.
Did he reference that study in the Newsweek article?
Yes, he did.
So that's the way to go back and vet that piece, is to go mine that study.
Great point. That's always the way to do it. As you're looking at your source, whether it's a footnote or a bibliography or a hyperlink in an article, you always want to figure out, how do they know that's true? Where do they get their information? And just go back and figure out where they got their information. And by the way, just in terms of ethics, it's extremely important. Coach Baker, the first night, talked about how you can cite a piece, you know, how the Blue Book cites it, which is, you know, I think a really good way to do it. It doesn't have to be standard. It's not, you know, written in stone. It's not an NCFCA guideline or anything. But as you cite your sources consistently, you can get up there and say, you know, Jonathan Alter in Newsweek magazine said. What you wouldn't want to say is the ERIS survey, the American Religious Identification Survey, said, and then quote Newsweek. Because it's quoted in Newsweek, but it's Newsweek's interpretation of that event. So, how, you know, imagine if you have, you know, two kids are in an argument in the other room, and your mom calls you in and say, what happened? Well, I heard it was this and this, and then, well, and you heard what's going on. Well, Johnny hit Jenny. And that's not what happened at all, you know. It's like the old game of telephone. You know, by the time it gets around the table, it's completely different. But it's also intellectually dishonest and intellectually lazy to get in and quote a source like Newsweek and say, ERIS said, or say, oh, this is cool because now I got a twofer. I have, you know, extemporaries try this a lot. I've got a quote from Newsweek, I've got a quote from ERIS, and I've got a quote, you know, I've got three sources and it's one article. This is awesome. You just want to make sure that you're ethical in how you're presenting it, because ultimately, when you give the article to the judge, and the judge says, because your opponent's going to say, that's not what the study said, that's what Jonathan Alter interpreted from the study, or whoever the person who wrote the article. Jonathan Alter is the editor of Newsweek. So whoever said it, that's what they said about the study. And if the negative presses you on that, and the judge calls for a piece of evidence, you just lost the round. You picked up a very important lesson. Debate rounds don't develop character, they reveal it. Scrooge Report, again, they're quoting Newsweek and quoting the study. You want to make sure that you're just consistent on that. Obviously, you don't quote a sign. Well, I was driving down the street. But here's a great source. You can go and go to the summary report. And isn't that a night chart? Even with my prescription, I can't read that. So you're looking at this this table that appears in the study. And they're looking at all sorts of denominations, all different time periods. And you have to go through and get your calculator out and say, okay, of the non-white, of the black non-Hispanic, of the Hispanic, of the Asian groups, in 2008, how many answered a certain way, total 100%, so we have to go down and count up all the numbers, and that's where they got their 48%. And you can see, as you go through, Catholic has gone from 27 down to 17, Charismatic has gone from a Pentecostal Charismatic is down from 3 down to 0. Mormon LDS from 2 down to 0. Eastern Orthodox, 0 up to 21. Part of that number is who is surveyed, how they identify. Part of that number is how they interpret the question in their own mind, how the question is written and how they respond to it. So the important thing is, as you get back to this source, is even knowing what question was asked. Because you might walk away more convinced than ever that we are in a Christian country. The countries can be Christian any more than flowers could be Christian. But the people in America are governed more or less by an ethical code that finds its root in Judeo-Christian faith. Whether it's our bankruptcy laws or our civil laws or so forth. And then, you know, if you think it's wrong to steal, for example, if employers, and they do, think it's wrong to steal, and employers, and I have, and others have, fired people for stealing or for doing things that are dishonest, the only reason they do that is because we as a culture think stealing is wrong. Why? Because the commandment says, thou shalt not steal. When there are cultures that think stealing is okay. Hey, if you got over on the man, you're cool. Showed him. You taught him a good lesson. And so we have to realize that. How many of you read the book, or seen the book by Dinesh D'Souza on Christianity? Response. Interesting book, and he talks about people who eat at the trough of Christianity. Newsweek and some other people here are running on underlying assumptions, eating at the trough of Christianity. There are moral assumptions. Why is this important to this discussion? You want to, as you investigate secondary and primary sources, you want to be able to, if you're trying to spot bias, you want to think in terms of their underlying assumptions. What I'm suggesting takes a lot of work. The reason I'm suggesting, I don't want to bore you to tears or make you walk away from debate and think LD's easier after all. What I want you to do is realize that the facts are out there if you'll find them, and I don't want you, most people use source books incorrectly. You want to go and find the magic piece of evidence, this super powerful card. I'm going to power tag everything. And you're going to go and find this card, and you're going to read it, and you're going to win a round. And what you want to do is be able to be so versed in the subject that you, in cross-examination, when they follow their line of questioning, you can stand up under fire because you know the truth. And that's ultimately where you want to be, and research gets you there. The primary thing that we want to think about today is ultimately primary sources, if you can find them, if you have them available, are always best. Are you going to find a primary source to support your case? Maybe not. Maybe you've got a case idea. How many of you have started your research last night? Yesterday, you're doing research in two sessions on everything from taxing plastic bags to nuclear power and all kinds of other things, right? How many of you have already completed your mandates? Got an idea what your mandates are going to be? Awesome. How many of you have your inherent barriers all already nailed down? Not the same hands. How can you have your mandates in place if you don't know what your inherent barriers are? Because if your plan is so good, why hasn't it been passed already? Research takes you to a place, and I don't want to, you know, get in line of anything else that's been said before. I'm not here to contradict anything, but the most important thing is let the research guide your decision, because otherwise you might come up with mandates, and it's okay early on to come up with mandates. You might come up with mandates that are going to be wrong or that are specious. Your argument might be specious. Don't quote a source without having referenced it. It's so important. If there was one takeaway that you have from this whole meeting, is don't just pull a source out of a source book or offline and just read it as though it's true and around, just because it says what you want it to say. Because what if they made it up? What if they made a mistake? I mean, even I make mistakes. No, really. You know, it can happen. You want to begin your research strategically. You want to understand the limitations of secondary sources, but realize the benefits of secondary sources. What are some of the benefits of secondary sources? So I'm thinking like Google. I'm thinking like some of the journals that I mentioned before, environmental studies or interpretations of environmental studies. They're out there. They're abundant. They're wonderful to get. The purpose is to find the truth. Fact-checking. Fact-checking should lead you to primary source material. So if you're doing things correctly in your research, you should be aware of if there's a Supreme Court case that becomes important for your discussion. You know, if you're doing nuclear power, when's the last time we built a nuclear reactor in this country that was for civilian use? And if it's been, you know, 30 years or more, why is that? Why aren't we, if they're so great, why aren't we building more of them? What's in the way? You ought to know the answer to that question. No one here this week or next week is going to be here to tell you what to think. What we want to do is try to give you tools to help you think and guide you in the process of discovering information. That's all I have for the session, and we're done early.
Okay.